This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the Unsung Podcast, where we talk about classic albums and decide if they deserve that distinction. And we also talk about some unsung classics in the hopes of bringing them to a new audience. And at the end of it all, we let you decide if we are right or wrong. This is the Unsung Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Fraser. I'm joined by...
To my left is Chris Cusack, who invented flat Pringles. He's also been married to Pauline Quirk 3 times.
She's just opened a dance school or acting school in Glasgow, you know.
Yeah, I know. I saw that on the back of a bus. I saw the advert.
No, the school's not in the back of the bus.
the school's also on the back of a bus.
I'm bound to bump into her as well. That's going to be really awkward because they're on like our third settlement.
Did you know that the phrase did you know the phrase "a quirk of fate" is actually to do with Pauline Quirk?
She invented
venom.
Oh, really?
She's actually one of the most poisonous animals in the world.
That's astonishing.
Yep.
But probably true because you said it.
You were married to her 3 times, you should know.
We barely spoke. That was really just a way to get to, what's her name? Was it Dorian in Birds of a Feather? The dark-haired...
Dorothy? Oh, it might be Dorian. I don't know.
Whoever the promiscuous dark-haired housewife was, yeah.
The cougar.
Yeah, I was just really going through Pauline to get to her. But yeah, to my right is Dave Weaver, who has been trying to grow a sort of new metal, sort of Serge Tankian System of a Down... kind of beard thing, but it's not been working, so he's taken to shaving his back and using those hairs because he feels they're softer and more likely to attract the caresses of young
young carry on.
I'm realising what a difficult time this is to make jokes about anything of that sort. So young pensioners. Nobody cares about pensioners getting molested.
I thought these bits
nobody. Pensioners, you could molest pensioners up and down the place day and night, and folk would probably be like,
because humanity,
oh, that's nice. He's helping them out, making them feel wanted.
Because humanity's so fucked that we know that all pensioners at some point have done something terrible, so they deserve whatever they get.
What if what they get is the downy fluff from your back glued to your chin in a new metal style? Anyway, yeah, do we have a show?
The public have decided that Foo Fighters by Foo Fighters is not getting voted into discography. Make of that what you will. Yeah, on this episode we're talking about Violator by Depeche Mode, which was my choice.
It was indeed.
Why was it your choice?
I wanted to choose something a bit different for the rock stuff we were doing, primarily. And also, I really love this record. I like the sound of it. I think it's been really influential to a lot of, not just electronic music, but bands generally, I think, too. And it's just full of bangers. It's just wall-to-wall bangers.
You were being so respectable and kind of above board in your disco. It was just like...
Just full of bangers,
mate. Shorted out.
Bangers.
Totally banging,
just full of bangers. How, I disagree.
You're gonna
no,
have to
no. So
the...
how did you get into this album? How did you find
it? A friend recommended it to me when I was in college. I'd never heard Depeche Mode before, and they were like, "Yeah, you should listen to Violator by Depeche Mode." And I was like, "That's the band that did that song. Just can't get enough. Nah, not like that." It's just
mate,
like, no.
Classic.
Listen to it.
Yeah, 63 wins in a trot. You do get a wee bit sick of it, but what can I say? We're just that good.
And I was like, I listened to it, and the first thing that hit me about it was the production. I think the production is just immense. The strings, the way that all the sequencing and the synths are just arranged. The arrangement as well, I guess, and the production, both things work hand in hand really well. And I wasn't really expecting it. Plus, it's really fucking dark, man. I'm pretty sure Dave Gagan was coming off. Is it Dave Gagan? Is it Gagan?
Gagan.
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 The lead vocalist, I'm pretty sure he was just coming off, or had just come off heroin at the time. So it informed quite a lot of the lyrical choices as well. So yeah.
When you chose this one, I have to admit I didn't really know a lot about Depeche Mode. So it was the one that I've had to kind of spend the most time trying to really try and understand. I take your point about it being dark. I didn't find it as dark as I expected it to be. From what you'd said, given, you know, it was 1990 it came out. There was some pretty dark music kicking about at that time, you know, and I mean that was like kind of era of or early Nine Inch Nails, early Ministry and stuff. And I didn't find this to be like.
But it's clear they weren't listening to anything like that. They were coming from the synth pop background, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but you
really
got
dark
it,
for
but,
them.
But the album immediately after this is
Faith and Devotion.
Yeah, Faith and Devotion is the one where they clearly demonstrated, like he was quite outspoken about how much he admired Nirvana and Soundgarden and these bands that were there at the time, and they went for quite a big kind of dark rocky sound. So I mean they didn't live in a vacuum as big as they were. Like I get the somber kind of like, you know, minor nature of it, but I didn't find it overbearingly downbeat.
Well, funnily enough, I kind of came from an opposite perspective of that, in that I'd never really listened to this album before either. And my previous Depeche Mode sort of experience was Just Can't Get Enough. And
by the way, that was their first album.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And I'm not going to lie, I fucking love cheesy 80s pop. One of the best albums of all time, and maybe we'll do it on this, is Tears for Fears, Songs from Big Chair. Fucking love Kate Bush. I love fucking, you know, early Talk Talk, as well as, you know, their Madge, you know, post-rock shit later on. My most subscribed playlist on Spotify is my 80s playlist.
Your entire life is a dare.
I mean, there's nothing I don't do that isn't wrapped in wads of irony. But I'd heard Enjoy the Silence off this record, which is a fucking great track. All I ever wanted, all I ever needed is here in my arms. Words are very unnecessary, they can only do harm. Obviously heard the Marilyn Manson cover of Personal Jesus. Oh, look at Chris's face.
Not the Johnny Cash one. No.
I only just found out that Marilyn Manson didn't have his testes removed in that accident where the prop fell on him, and I'm a little disappointed.
He didn't have his testes or his ribs removed when he was a teenager so he could suck his own dick. He didn't have any. He's never
sometimes
had any
fake news is better news. Okay.
So I came from this quite blank, and for me, I always thought of Depeche Mode as a big 80s pop band.
Yeah, me too.
In the
yeah.
same sort of vein as Duran Duran.
Erasure.
Tears for Fears, Erasure, who I fucking love. And for me, this was, because my expectations were different, this was a lot darker than I thought it would be. And I was like, when I listened to this, I was like, oh, I can totally see how this has been influential amongst the sort of gothy stuff, the electro stuff, you know, Nine Inch Nails, Ministry, Marilyn Manson, that whole, it sort of tied into that more than the, you know, that big pop, you know, glossy stuff from the mid-80s.
I think like, you, again, this is all just based on me trying to kind of get to grips with this band a little bit more thoroughly, but the Just Can't Get Enough stuff, the 1981 stuff, what was it, I can't remember the name of the album, but the, Vince Clarke was a big part of that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the, he not former Erasure,
yeah,
I believe. So like he left, did that band Yazoo, depending on what country you're from. And then did Erasure, and you can really hear that and just can't get enough. I mean, that is like, that could have been an Erasure song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think Depeche Mode, I just don't, maybe we're just seeing it from totally different perspectives here. I see Depeche Mode as quite a somber band. That's like, I see them as quite like, Enjoy the Silence was the tune. It's a great song. It's a song that when I was a kid and I was listening passively to radio, it stood out as being particularly good, and it still does stand out as being particularly good. But yeah, I think they did suggest to me the opposite. So it's interesting that Dave's got such different perspective on them, because yeah, there absolutely were a whole bunch of bands around that time that are sort of peers of theirs, but certainly I wouldn't associate creatively, I wouldn't associate in terms of their outlook or approach to what they were doing. This was like very, I think Depeche Mode, it also seems, are taken really, really seriously, you know, like by people that like them. I know they have massive appeal, but the musicians that like them are big enthusiasts of the band and of their technical prowess, of the work they did with synthesizers, you know, the advances they made, and the sound that this album in particular, I believe, is considered to be quite daring and quite boundary pushing in terms of like.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The arrangement and production.
I think in that sense, I mean, we kind of spoke about this briefly at some point. I don't think it sounds too dated. I think a lot of the sequencing on it and sort of synthesizer sounds are now so commonplace, but done in a sort of ironic kind of way that it doesn't really make it sound as dated as it probably should. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, it would be interesting to know what impact the technology had on this album, because this is one thing you forget when you're doing electronic music, more so than guitar music, is that the technology of the era affects electronic music far more substantially than it affects guitar music. Even though there are advances in guitar music, and even though you get bands that can now play through laptops that make all the pedal changes for them, the differences are far more apparent in electronic music, where the technology suddenly makes possibilities apparent that were never even considered before, or were incredibly difficult before. You know, Kraftwerk were going through banks of things to do something you can now do on a phone. So it's... And it would be interesting to see how much of, as forward-looking as a lot of what they did is said to be, it would be quite interesting to really know how much of that was enabled by advances in technology of the time, because I'm not really sure what gear they were using. Not that I'm not trying to downplay the accomplishment of their album, but it is interesting with electronic music to kind of bear that in mind when you're listening to it. Like, how much of this is an idea they had, and how much of this is actually a technical thing that was put in front of them, and like, you can do this now. And they're now, and so therefore they take advantage of it.
I mean, I think that's a good point. But then the next record, Songs, Faith and Devotion, they kind of
rejects
it entirely. Not entirely, because there's still a lot of synthesizers, a lot of keyboards on it, but there's way more guitars, and there's definitely that grunge influence. I think the thing that appealed to me most about Violator, though, and probably came along at the right time when I heard it as well, is the whole vibe and atmosphere of it is really not electro at all. You know, it almost feels metal in a lot of ways, even though they were probably never metal fans.
It feels more goth, I find.
Well, that's a big goth element. I mean, is goth it being dreary as goth as sometimes can be?
It's a wee bit dreary.
You know? Yeah, it definitely is, but it's not like...
His vocal lines are quite morose, but... Yeah. I don't know, I really like... There's like a sparseness to the production that I really liked that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Because, I was surprised to see that it was 1990 that it came out. I just always associated them with being an 80s band.
Mm. Well, they didn't have a number one album until 91 or 92, which is interesting. Like, because it was Songs of Faith and Devotion that came in and went to number one. So, like, as big as they were at this time, I think they were I think it was when this album came out, they sold, there was a 48,000 capacity stadium in the States that sold out in half an hour when this album came out. But they weren't a number one album. So it was like, it was a sustained, you know, succession of albums. Because, I mean, this was the seventh, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they've been going for a long time at this point, you know. And that's the other remarkable thing about it as well. They made a
seven albums in 9 years, actually. It's not that long. It's quite impressive. Like,
and after that, they took a lot of time between albums in some cases.
Yeah, but that's because people thought they were breaking up, right?
Yeah. Oh, because Alan Wilder left, like, later on down the line. I think after Ultra, he left.
Yeah, but they didn't think they were going to reform. I think not before that, but they didn't think they were going to continue.
Yeah, because there was a lot of discontent before they went into Songs of Faith and Devotion. Because they totally decided to make a conscious effort to change up the style of how this album was made as well, compared to the previous stuff, which I think probably had quite a lot of say in the way that it was composed and the structure, you know?
Apparently, for this one in particular, they decided... To not have Martin Gore overly finish the demos for it. Like, he was very much like in a position of doing a lot of composition, I believe, or whoever was doing the demos were left much more sparse to enable the band to put more of the band's influence into the music for this one. So I understand it anyway.
I guess that's when, if you look at the credits of the record, you actually see that a lot of the compositional aspects of it actually come from Alan Wilder as well. So like you had like...
There was an interesting breakdown that said he was the facilitator, Martin Gore was the ideas man, and Dave Gann was the personality of like in terms of how the three, the dynamic worked.
So like I think... I could be wrong here, but the way I understand it is a lot of the sort of synthy sounds and the kind of pads and all that were very much compositional part of Alan Wilder's sort of thing, and Martin Gore was more the kind of the sequencing and synthesizers, and then, you know, Gahan was the voice.
It's interesting, I believe this is still, though, even though it didn't come in as high in the charts, this is their biggest selling album of the
because period. Because of like the two, I mean, I think... From what I understand, when Personal Jesus first came out, people weren't expecting that. Like, they weren't expecting to hear, like, Depeche Mode doing a song like this, and it kind of prefaced this record, which, I mean, Personal Jesus is very lyrically dark.
But and I think musically...
It's not.
It doesn't fit in the album.
It's quite
It stands out. It's different.
Do you know, the Personal Jesus is really anomalous in the album for a few reasons. It's like, they did a lot of stuff in Milan for this album, but it was the only song they recorded in Milan.
The rest was in Norway, wasn't it? Denmark,
It was Denmark. The rest was done elsewhere, and they actually, well, according to them, they got pretty hedonistic in Milan with the time there, rather than recording much. But I was fascinated to find out about the kind of primitive version of a viral campaign they did for Personal Jesus. Did you hear about this?
Like, no.
So they took out adverts in newspapers that just said "Your own Personal Jesus," and then they took them out again that said "Your own Personal Jesus" and had the phone number, and you could phone the phone number and that track would play on the phone number, and so like their fans were like ringing up this line all the time. And it was like an early attempt at like really alternative marketing, like a really unusual approach to it, and it seemed to create quite a buzz ahead of the album coming out. So it is a bit of an outlier in a few ways, Personal Jesus on the album, apart from just the way it sounds.
It does definitely sound a bit strange compared to the rest of the record. I mean, Enjoy the Silence is a lot closer to the actual overall aesthetic of the record, I think, on the whole. There's a lot of tunes on this record which are just, I don't know, they make me feel really uneasy. And I've never really felt that before when I'd heard electronic music. And every single time, even to this day, when I hear Martin Gore's backing vocals, because it's really high, almost womanly sort of backing vocal, it always just gets me. I can't really describe why, but it just does something for me, which I think is pretty incredible.
It's something for France as well. It was number one there.
Was it?
It was one of the only countries that went to number one. And it's weird because you're talking about some of it. I don't know why subconsciously I just associate Depeche Mode, as big as they were in the States, with being really popular in France.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had this total misconception as well. I thought at least two of the main members in Depeche Mode were gay. And apparently they're not.
No.
I have no idea. I just they'd always, to me, just been a band that was like a large proportion of the band were gay. And I don't know where I got that idea. So it's just a little bit of trivia there, but I honestly don't know where that came from. And I just was like quite, that's weird. The music made less sense to me once I knew they weren't gay. I was like, And I guess the innuendo and stuff, I sort of liked it less once I knew they weren't gay. I was like, okay.
There are some creepy songs on the track, like Blue Dress, you know what I mean? Like, that's a pretty...
Apparently, Gore said that he described Blue Dress as being pervy, I believe, was the phrase.
And it is. Some of the lyrics are. And
just about watching a woman get dressed.
Yeah, which is kind of strange. And there are songs about...
That's strange, but yeah.
I mean, I guess, for if you thought they were gay, I guess it's pretty strange. I don't know, I think World in My Eyes is a really good opener because it clues you right into the atmosphere of the record immediately, and you kind of get the sense you're going to get taken on this weird journey. And I kind of, it must have been even more staggering as a fan of the band to be like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is not the Depeche Mode I signed up for.
I have to say, like, and I'm obviously not overly familiar with this album. I've been trying pretty hard to get used to that. I think the first two songs are two of the weakest songs on it.
Well, I think I'd probably agree with that. I think it's a good opener to clue you into the record.
I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a massive fan, though, and he thinks the second tune is one of their best. So it was like, it's strange how, again, opinions vary dependent on how significant the band is to you personally. You know, this is a band that I don't have much vested in. I'm open-minded about it, but, you know, for example, for me on this album, the standout track was Halo. I think it's an excellent song, like with really interesting chords and really interesting lines in it, but it's not a single. It's, you know.
Yeah, funnily enough, coming from a similarly sort of blank background, Halo was the one that stood out for me as well. Yeah.
It's really nice, and I mean, Enjoy the Silence is a great song as well, obviously, but that's weird that kind of really came across, that tune. But so I'm not sure how you, as a fan of the album, you see the peaks and troughs.
When I first heard it, the song that stood out to me the most was Clean at the end, because it's just like Dave like singing it in this like void almost, and he's got that weird reverb on his voice, and it kind of builds, and it's just, I don't know, I keep coming back to this word atmosphere, and it comes back to the atmosphere of the record. It just makes me feel really odd, and I just love that about it, you know. Halo is also a really good song. I do like Blue Dress a lot. Waiting for the Night, I also love that. I think that's
I've been listening to this.
That was meant to be called Waiting for the Night to Fall.
Yeah, which is the actual lyric.
I was just going to say, I've been listening to this album like over the last couple of nights walking back from work, and it just seems like a really fucking perfect album. Walking back, nighttime, cold.
Get jumped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, through the city, you know, down weird sort of...
walking, abandoned. Man? You could walk up well-lit roads. I know where you live. They've got street lights. You don't have to be walking down
I'm going through Tradeston, man. Fucking hell, it's mental here. But, you know, it's like just really good soundtrack for a slightly, you know... It's a nighttime album. Mm-hmm. It's a totally. Winter album. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not one you're going to fucking pump on the beach at, you know, 7 p.m. and
not
July
even
or
not even Enjoy the Silence. Not
you know who wants to be Depeche Mode? A band close to your heart, Dave. Orgy.
Orgy. I mean,
I own two Orgy records.
I didn't even know Orgy had two records.
The first two
are records. They both the same record?
Basically. Yeah.
I mean, they did cover Blue Monday. Yeah.
Of course they did.
And
what else did they do?
You know, New Order, New Order, another band that are sort of that era, sort of, you know, peers of Depeche Mode. And but Depeche Mode are just darker. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Policy of Truth, and I'll stand it for me as well. I'm pretty sure it was a single. I think that was the third single on the record.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Because it has that big chorus with a weird kind of synth horns. Yo.
I don't get a lot from that song. It's one of the most memorable ones, but it's not memorable in a way that really, like, you know, I'm not sure. It's strange coming to an album that's got such a significance and yet struggling to, like, find the in, you know, find the access points of, like I said, like, I think Enjoy the Silence and the chorus of Halo and a couple others are real ways that you can find your way in under the armour and start to kind of get into it. But man, some of the other stuff, it just, I don't know if it's a case of it dating or if I don't know if I'm just not, it's just not something that's intended to, or it's just not something that's compatible with
my life. Going back to something you said, I think that maybe some of it's, I don't know, like, vitality has been dampened by how influential it's been. Mm. And a lot of the, you know, the sequences and the, you know, the chord progressions and even the, you know, the vocal lines have been used so much by so many bands, particularly now, you know, because this music's so fucking fashionable right now.
But is this album more influential than their other work? Because Songs of Faith and Devotion, for example, seems like it was very high profile, and some of the stuff beforehand as well seems like it was very, very high profile. So, like,
they've always been a high profile band, though. Everything they've done has been met with great fanfare since the 80s.
To me, even this was always the Depeche Mode album I knew of, and this was maybe the crossover one, and it's the one that I've read about people, you know, always going back to, you know, fans from, you know, musicians from, you know, metal, goth, pop, always go back this one.
See, I always hear about Music for the Masses. That's the one that's always kind of mentioned.
One
to
before
me.
This, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you feel this album had more influence than that?
I think it's definitely had a lot more influence on a lot more 90s kind of goth artists. It's interesting when you think about the Songs of Faith and Devotion, just to think of it, just coming back to that for a wee second, is like, that just reminds me of being like a soundtrack for the Crow film.
It's an interesting analogy.
Even though it's not, but it sounds like it fits exactly in that, and that's very much of its time. I think Music for the Masses is probably the stepping stone towards getting to Violator, but I think Violator's probably still the outlier in their catalogue as well, and the sound of it, I think the actual overall sound of all the component parts of it still resonates to this day. The only thing that, I mean, I appreciated this album more after I started listening to the band Health. I don't know if you guys know Health.
Yeah, I know Health well.
Death Magic has got so much influence for this record on it. It's like staggering. And I went back and listened to that record, and I was like, I can hear it even more now in the stuff that's kind of like electro and current.
I feel like I'm on a different planet right now, because the Health that I think of is a million miles away from this.
They used to be, and then they became a pure electro fucking...
Yeah, Health used to be noise, but now
band.
They are like... Mm-hmm.
I think I must have tuned out.
Proper
after.
Electro.
Yeah, they're proper. Like,
but like, still good. But
yeah, imagine an electro band playing metal, but like not in a pure obvious industrial way. That's basically what Health sound like.
it's a big ask.
It's weird, but they've got weird stuff. They've got like blast beats and all that in songs where it was playing like really loud mad keyboards and stuff, and the production's pure pop and all that, and it's.
See,
that's a good record.
But, Death Magic, I saw them in stereo.
Yeah.
And like the time in, we're talking about Health now, but time in Glasgow they'd played before was in Captain's Rest.
Upstairs in the Captain's Rest.
And it was just absolute chaos. And then in stereo they played, and I really enjoyed it because the songs were good and they put on a good show, but like a lot of it was on backing track and a lot of it was, you know, about
Pitchfork.
It was
a pitchfork band, man.
They're such a pitchfork band.
Yeah, like,
and I really enjoyed that album, but I don't know, that live show left me feeling a bit empty.
I think that's a band that leaves me feeling really empty, I have to be honest. There's something horribly hollow about them, something really gutted out, and like the whole Pitchfork thing, like it's just, I can't put my finger on it, but yeah, we're getting sidetracked here, but
a lot of the vocal melodies on Death Magic are significantly taken from this record.
Really, that's interesting. I'd like to listen to that with that in mind, because yeah, it's an interesting pairing that I hadn't put together.
So there's a whole load of sort of like gothy electro dark stuff. Even coming from LA right now, you can tell is very Violator.
You feel like MGMT as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely a huge influence on them. And I don't even really like them, but what I've heard of them definitely sounds like they've taken some of the sounds directly from this record.
Jesus,
you know,
man. I mean, I think that's, we're now getting into the realm of making the point that so much of what is happening now is so painfully fucking lifted from the 80s retro.
A record which is now 27 years old.
Yeah. I mean, I say 80s retro, this is 1990, but you know what I mean? Like, I mean,
it's an 80s album. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like an 80s album.
I mean, it is definitely. It's, you can see that we're looking towards a new decade and going, we want to try and do something different, but they're still coming out with that hangover of having 80s sound, you know?
Do you think this is their best album?
I do, yeah.
Do you think it's the most, to use the analogy from an earlier episode and when we did the Converge, like, do you think it's also the most important album?
See, I don't know, because like I said at the start, or before we started recording, I was listening to Songs of Faith and Devotion recently, and that's definitely got, as a guitar player and someone that likes guitar music, that's got a much bigger appeal to me, just because sonically,
it is less typically Depeche Mode though, isn't it?
It is, but it just keeps coming back to the production and arrangement of this record for me. Every single time, it just makes my hair stand on end. Mm. Every single fucking time. Especially the string sounds. It just makes me go, wow, like that must have taken a lot of processing power to do back at that time to make it sound that good.
Well, that's kind of what I mean about the technology. Like, yeah. I wonder how big a part that played in terms of their creative decisions. What was possible sometimes makes your mind up for you, because this has never been possible before. We're rich enough to afford it, we should use it. And that's a big part of music in general. Jesus Christ, autotune, you know, that's an entire style of music that has grown just from the ability to do it, not because it should happen. You know, everybody was like, can we do it? And nobody thought, should we do it? You know, autotune is like the fucking Skynet of music. And I just like, yeah, I mean, the production in this, I like it. It is ghostly. It is quite very melancholy sparse and sparse.
It didn't need to be for them either, given the stuff that came before and after it. It didn't need to have that kind of empty void sound that it has.
And even the artwork as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about the aesthetics. I think the artwork as well, like, defines it perfectly, because, you know, it's just fucking black, little red line, little bit of, you know, it's, yeah, I think it works pretty perfectly and sort of, you know, summing it up visually.
I think
as well,
we can't obviously do it, but it'd be interesting to actually see, you know, a world without the influence of this album. You know, what albums in your opinion do you think wouldn't exist without this album? Maybe that's an interesting way to put it. Apart from Orgy.
I think a lot of Marilyn Manson's wouldn't exist without it, for sure.
The later stuff,
all
like Mechanical Animals kind of stuff,
all of it. I mean, he was hugely influenced by Trent Reznor as well, but there's a lot of sounds from, I guess, probably Smells Like Children onwards, which are just taken wholesale from the things that Depeche Mode are doing, especially the more melodic vocal lines, I would say.
It would be interesting to see a balance of influence, like if you could ever graph it between Depeche Mode and Nine Inch Nails as well, because
Pretty Hate Machine doesn't sound, I mean, there's definitely,
that's not, that to me, that's not optimum Nine Inch Nails.
It's though. Not, because I think probably to get at what Weaver's getting at as well, is like, it is that total thing of like, you can tell at some point he's listened to this record and went, I want to do something a bit like that, but with what I like to do.
Yeah.
You know, and then he comes out with, what was the next one? Downward Spiral, was that the next one?
I think Downward Spiral takes a lot from this album.
I think we'll probably end up encountering Downward Spiral in this series. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's a huge album for me personally as well. But I can take your point. And there's elements in Downward Spiral, like stuff in like A Warm Place and things like that, that I can see are influenced maybe by the arrangements on this. Mm-hmm. Those guys weren't far behind each other, so it's hard.
I think
to
vocally it's quite similar as well.
I think so.
I mean, there's not a lot in Downward Spiral. March of the Pigs. And
just overall, in like the sort of overall Nine Inch Nails, I see like Trent's vocals are quite, I don't know, like quite understated, mm-hmm. quite, I don't know, it's maybe the way that it's mic'd, it's maybe the way that it's like quite intense and personal, like it's, you know, it goes a lot, I don't know.
I'm just, yeah, I'm feeling a bit. I'm not getting that one at all, man, but I maybe with the later stuff. Maybe.
On his quiet, on the quiet Trent stuff, he's like.
Well, but that's well after Downward Spiral mostly anyway.
Yeah, I know, but like. That's well after Violator as well. I think like the influence of Violator in Nine Inch Nails goes probably like gets deeper as it goes on.
I would say that melodically, like vocally, melodically, Nine Inch Nails, which is a total tangent here, Nine Inch Nails have always, he's always got the same ideas that he just keeps recycling on every record, like vocally.
Yeah,
that's not the most interesting thing about Nine Inch Nails, obviously, but I definitely think there's a Depeche Mode influence on that. Even in the louder stuff he does as well, his vocal, just a bit of the delivery, you know.
That's true, but I mean, I guess a lot of vocalists tend to find a niche and sort of occupy it.
Yeah,
I mean,
use their safe notes.
Yeah, I mean, David Joe didn't have the biggest of ranges, but he's pretty idiosyncratic.
Yeah, as with Ross Cuomo.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I can definitely. Acquiesce to the notion that this is influential. This does seem like a good and strong representation of the work. So
what?
I can get with it. I mean, I'll be honest. I didn't feel a lot for this album. As I said, Halo was the standout track, but I would not fall out with the notion of it going through to, you know, some kind of list. The only caveat might be that if I had the time to really immerse myself in their back catalogue, I wonder if I wouldn't find an album that was more striking, and I feel from talking to people, almost everybody I've spoken to has a different Depeche Mode album that they prefer. So I'm kind of wary of, is this the one? So it'll be interesting to see how people react to it on that basis.
Yeah, I can totally understand that because they've got a huge body of work as well. So
oh, fuck, man, it's 17 albums or something like that. Yeah.
So there's going to be
100
something.
Million record sales is what I read at the last count.
What's interesting is talking about like 80s pop, and like for a lot of people. You know, that one single, Just Can't Get Enough, is their entry to Depeche Mode.
For a lot,
but as we found out...
60,000 people every Saturday, Dave.
But what we found out is that there's so much more to fucking Depeche Mode and they're influencing all these different genres. But there's so many bands like that in 80s pop who have their, like, one or two tracks that are the massive sort of era-defining genre tracks. And, like, a lot of these, maybe it was just the 80s and they were just given loads of cocaine and money... And they were allowed to do whatever the fuck they wanted, but you know, they became fucking massive off a couple of pop tracks, and then they were just allowed to do whatever the fuck they wanted. And sometimes that was good, sometimes that was bad. I don't know.
That's absolutely still the case. But you know, sometimes these bands benefit from a bit of autonomy and support. And the industry was different then. And if you demonstrated the ability to do stuff, you were allowed to run with it, and there weren't the same pressures exerted on you to conform. Depeche Mode wouldn't happen now because a band that sounded like Depeche Mode would never be allowed to branch off into such challenging directions unless they had, like I think Radiohead were the last ones to sneak under that door before it shut, where they're allowed to dictate the trajectory of their own career. It seems like the only ones now who could change their career would be to bend it towards the arc of conformity as opposed to away from. It doesn't seem very likely that many new bands, even if they are quite successful, are going to be allowed to stretch their legs the way these guys did on those many outlier albums from the sounds of it. You know, they're sort of like one of those kind of median graphs where it's like all the crosses are quite disparate. You draw the median line, and the median line is sort of, you know, this is what we think of Depeche Mode. But when you actually look at the points, some of their points are pretty far off that line. You know, you're like, yeah. Like, and it's interesting that they went in so many directions. You know, I respect that, at least, even if I don't, the album doesn't blow my mind.
So the panel decides then, should it go in or not?
I'm on the fence. I don't fall out with it. So my only concern is that I feel there may be a stronger Depeche Mode album.
Maybe more there.
But that is not shooting it down, and I'm reasonably comfortable with that going to the forum of public opinion.
Yeah, I'm the same. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot, and I can see how influential it was. I can't say if it's the defining Depeche Mode album, but you know,
Yeah, I think this is the only one you need, to be honest, personally.
Hey, man. It's your call.
My opinion. Well, we leave it to the public to decide, as they will. So please do go and vote. On our next episode, we'll be listening to
DJ Shadow introducing.
Okay. Cool.
Yep.
Fucking yes.
Yeah, well, we owe you one, man. So that's fine. I'll take that on the chin.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.